Hi, this is Aga and Łukasz, and this is Catching the Next Wave podcast, where we discuss the future of design.
And much more.
Hello, hello. We have a bonus episode today. The bonus episode is a great one for two reasons. The first reason are our guests, and the second reason is that this is actually the official opening of getting to season 10 of Catching the Next Wave.
I'm really curious what it will be about.
Ah, you're curious.
Yes, I'm very curious.
So you are guessing the theme, because the theme is going to be curiosity for this particular episode. And our guests are Anthony Rocco and Pim Schatz. Ah, Pim, you have such a difficult family name. Schatz Habel.
Pim, you say it and we will cut it and paste it instead of Agas.
Pim Schatz Habel.
Yeah, that one.
Both Pim and Anthony are experienced designers. We all got to know each other through the College of Extraordinary Experiences. Both Pim and Anthony were already guests on our podcast.
But separately.
Separately, yes. Yep. But today we are going to talk about something that both Anthony and Pim did together, which is a training on curiosity. So first of all, Pim and Anthony, so awesome to have you with us today again.
Thank you for having us. The thing that I wanted to say is we talked beforehand, and something that I associate with having learned from you is this phrase, do not talk. Do you remember that?
Of course I do.
There's a big confusion about these words, right?
Yeah. And so our hope for this podcast episode is maybe less of a conversation as it's normally thought of, and maybe a little bit more of an experience that we can walk you two through.
Let's embody your saying, and rather than us talking about curiosity, let's practice it together.
That sounds awesome. Before we get to this, though, I would love to ask you, how did it all start?
There's curiosity at its finest pulls all of the threads. And it could say that it started when you and I met in the castle and proceeded to concoct a crazy dance performance thing. You could say it started when him and I met on a phone call to make a strange happening happen here in California.
There's all these threads that are sowing a seed to emerge into something new. And one of the things that Anthony and I have been able to do so for the last year and a half is we were suddenly physically in the same spot, being San Francisco, California. And that allowed us to do something different than the random or more incremental threads. And I think one of the things that we just kept saying to each other was, what if we just keep showing up? Just spend time if it's valuable. And where do we go from there?
Then from all the possible topics in the universe, you chose curiosity and you decided to be curious about curiosity. There must be something that triggered you, I guess.
The thing that we've been playing with is this piece. It's hard for me to say that it was me that chose curiosity and maybe just curiosity knocked on our door and we answered it. There's this, I forget who it was exactly, maybe it's Tom Waits, but someone sort of said something about writing a song. It's like, you don't write the song just sort of comes to you and you write it down. Curiosity just is a force, it is an energy, it is an innate human quality that is looking for folks all around the world to share their version of how it shows up in them and inspire others to discover that inside themselves. And so we're just, you know, this podcast is called Catching the Next Wave. We're just part of a group of humans in the world right now that are listening to that particular wave, kind of riding it. I don't feel like it was a very voluntary choice. I feel like there were several times where Pim and I maybe were thinking about something else, and curiosity kept just being like, no, this is the thing you're going to be called to work on. And I was like, okay, I guess that's the thing.
Time to surrender, huh?
Elizabeth Gilbert shares how she believes that the universe has all these like creations, and depending on who is listening or receiving them, they're basically channeling something that the universe wants to create. And I love that idea. It's just listening to what you in this moment can and want to create, and maybe even have to create. A lot of people talk about passion or purpose or values, and there is something interesting when you start a project which doesn't really have a start or an ending, and then it just keeps on calling you, and not only on an intellectual level, it just shows up everywhere, and it's almost like your whole being isn't able to do otherwise, even though that sounds ridiculous maybe.
No, it doesn't. That's a bit,
Do you want to get philosophical and into free will and this kind of stuff?
We can get there. But before we get there, what you're saying resonates very deeply with me, because we have a tendency of suppressing those callings because they often are not what the traditional career is. So very often, instead of working on curiosity, you could go and work as a UX designer. So on the one hand, it requires surrender, but on the other hand, it requires a lot of intentionality to actually be able to follow through with these kind of ideas rather than follow with what is the choice expected from so many of us, isn't it?
Yeah, there is this beautiful idea that emerged in many of the interviews, which was people thinking that they're crazy or weren't able to do a thing, or the thoughts that they had were impossible. And all of them shared that there was always one person to believe in them, or even a stranger. There was this person who was sharing about a fear of diving, and that in a public pool there was, I can't exactly remember if it was a child or another adult, who was supporting them, and they felt that this one person truly believed they could dive, and they were able to dive in the pool. I think both of us have always held that, well, who's the one person to believe in us? And while I'm sitting here, I'm actually reframing it, and I think it's Anthony believed in me. We supported each other and following through.
Thanks, Pim. That means a lot hearing that. Never heard you say that quite that way.
Yeah, it's just I'm realizing that we were looking for external, but I don't think this project would have been there if it wasn't for us showing up.
I seem to pick up two themes entangled here. So one is basically persevering at something that you are not certain about. And maybe part of this is being curious and having this curiosity in you. But the other thing is the subject that you decided to chase, which is, you know, being curious about curiosity, how you framed it. So I would like to go back to this question. And then you said that curiosity showed up and picked you. But there must have been something intriguing or interesting for you in it that you picked it between, you know, many ideas that are probably constantly knocking at your door.
So this is where the skills of years of design and artistry and creation come in. You know, Pim and I have individually had interesting paths. And so that affords us this certain sort of muscle memory, a skill set that we've built over those years to distill to essence. And so when we kept kind of looking at the things or being distracted by something else, we both kept getting called back to the center of gravity, that was the curious. It's like, well, sure, innovation is this thing, but what's underneath that? Curiosity. And sort of the same way that you would distill down the periodic table of elements. Now, granted, that's still just a moment in space and time. You can go deeper into the elements and say, well, there's these subatomic particles and we're going to name them and define them and things like that. But there's sort of this snapshot in space and time where you're like, well, but all those subatomic particles acting in a certain way will manifest as these set of things. And here's kind of the table of that. And periodic table is a great example of like that thing actually emerging through someone's dream. I forget the exact scientist, but they tell the story of the actual image of the table coming to them in a dream. That piece around curiosity of like, there's probably more subatomic things happening, but curiosity sits at this level where it is the root of so many other things that emerge off of it, that all of those threads, both personal, professional, familial, whatever thread we pulled on would tie back into this innate power of curiosity.
And to talk about that space and time, we were, or still are, in a period of a global pandemic, which if you look at a moment of fear and uncertainty is something a lot of people have felt, maybe in more or less extreme ways. And to be able to work with fear or uncertainty, you have to cultivate curiosity, because it's kind of the antidote to fear. And one of the things that curiosity embraces is embracing the unknown. So it does feel resonant with the time that we were in that moment.
Pim, you mentioned interviews, and I remember that it all started with a series of 50 interviews. Could you tell a bit more about that part of your journey?
I would also hesitate to say that that's any sort of starting point or origin point, but there was a moment in time, there is a chapter in which him and I were cut off because of the COVID pandemic from something that I believe, and I'll speak for you, Pim, I believe that we both get a lot of nourishment out of meeting humans, both humans that we have relationships with, as well as new emerging, meeting for the first time relationships, and having deeper forms of connection. And there was the removal of social gatherings, the removal of conferences and these spaces where you would have these convenings gatherings. And we, being the experienced designers that we are, asked ourselves the meta question, how are we going to supplement that for ourselves? And it had very little to do with doing a bit of research for me. It wasn't like, oh, I'm going to do this research and from this is going to emerge a thing. It was, I have a partner in crime, which does a lot if we look at the idea of alibi or that sort of set of permission that one needs to then do an experience. On my own, I would have felt very afraid to conduct ritualized interviews with people over Zoom, but I had Pim believed that we could do this thing, going back to that point. So we were like, well, this is a fun game you and I like to play with each other. Now I'm speaking to Pim. This is a fun game we like to play to each other, and we're going to invite someone to come play this game with us. And maybe we'll do it 10 times. Maybe we'll do it 20 times. We ended up doing it 75 times. And it was just the fun of playing the thing.
Yeah, and I think the chapter research interviews or even research rituals, they were us observing curiosity at play. And one of the things that is something I didn't realize at the time, but we didn't go into the existing research, what is out there already, because it would bias our findings while we were in the interview. So we wanted to be open to explore something new, which is also some of the meanings within curiosity. You're open to explore. And we thought that, you know, we would do 20, maybe 30 interviews and we would check the box. We have all the answers. We know what it is. And right, you're laughing because the thing itself is the answer to it. Because showing up to the interview is us practicing curiosity over and over and over again while we're asking the same questions. And being able to hear each and every individual share their answer and how different it is and how subtle the differences can be. Remembering that interview 25, that was tough. I mean, I was bored a little bit and I had to like overcome the struggle of going through it, while at interview 40 or maybe 45, there were so many new mind-blowing things that we were hearing that both me and Anthony were looking at each other and were questioning why the previous 45 participant haven't mentioned this thing. So there was something transforming in ourselves by doing these interviews. And we can speak to that later, the principles that we now are using to teach curiosity have emerged from all these 75 interviews. So it's, as Elizabeth Gilbert would say, we're just channeling all these people together. And it's not our model or our framework or our teaching. It's sort of a collective wisdom of humans.
And to that point that Pim's talking about is like, we entered, or I'll speak for myself and say that I entered even with the assumption that we were going to pull out some bit of knowledge, and that knowledge be very informational in nature. And going back to the do not talk, it was surprising for me as an experience designer, the reminder that the principles are not concepts or information. They are ways of being and ways of doing that we learned through the process of doing it by observing others do it. So the best metaphor I can kind of use is the same way that you do when you're exercising or you're learning a language, or you're actually learning something that requires practice over time, and not a, I'm going to just get a new piece of information and operate differently. And that is like to that question of like, well, what is it? It's like the thing itself is the answer to it, because it's not a simple sentence. That's why we can sometimes seem avoidant, but it's a very subtle differentiation between words and this is the insight and this is the knowledge. And like, no, I have to show you what we're doing internally to be curious.
Okay, so you mentioned that instead of talking about it, we could practice those principles. Shall we give it a try?
Yeah. So to mention, at this moment in time, this time frame, there are 6 principles. And to practice them, we can just go past them one by one. And important to say is that they stack on top of each other. So there is an order. And the first principle is observing.
Well, can we say one more thing, Pim?
You can say many more things.
I think the context that you two would also appreciate is the intention that we learned from a few different interviews around a principle different than a value. This is maybe the most piece of cognitive thing that sort of shifted for me, is dipping the principle into a verb. So every word that we'll kind of present and that there's a principle of, it's an active verb rather than a value, which is sort of like a noun. And so that, just as a little conceptual framing, and now I'll let him jump in again.
I could imagine this being a verb and an adjective. So you do something in a certain way, but definitely not a noun.
If you hear some strange noise, these are little blocks shifting in my head as we speak.
What is so beautiful about it being a verb is you can personalize whatever practice, ways in which you want to practice the principle, which is less abstract than how does a value show up in your life.
And as principle. We do this, I will invite everyone listening along to do this along with us.
Absolutely.
Reminder, do this along with us.
Yeah, the first principle is observing, inviting all your senses to notice what is around you. So my question to both people that are listening, whether you're sitting in a room or you're walking, where are you? And what do you hear around you? What do you feel? Are you sitting? Are you standing? Are you thirsty? What's the temperature of your body? And then to Anthony, Aga, and Lukasz, what are you observing while we are recording?
That's a tricky question, obviously, and it changed while you were asking the questions. And I noticed I have a filter that is basically going through all the inputs and decides to ignore some of them or not. So when you were asking these questions, the filter was switching itself off, and I get all these different input from all the senses that came through my brain. But since we are recording and I have to keep an eye here on whether these little lights show up properly, I kind of decided not to hold on to them, but just, you know, notice them, appreciate, and limit to the selection that I know I need. So paying the most attention basically to you, because you were guiding me through something, trying to ignore the moment that I should have drunk water before we even started, and it's like really damn hot here, but if I open the window, there will be a noise coming in. So just, so this observation kind of focused it on what we are doing here, with tiny percentage making sure that it will get recorded and people will get to experience that. It was a wave that went through, so like the input opened and then it closed again, and I felt more conscious about what I was shutting off, but it kind of feels better. Even probably do the same thing as before you ask these questions, but I'm feeling more comfortable with this quote-unquote choices right now, weirdly enough.
For me, like I mentioned before we started recording, I had an extremely busy day, so like starting the conversation has already calmed me down, so I was already more focused on talking to you guys and having this conversation and being present in it. So I'm in a breathing training. I'm relearning how to breathe properly. And of course, when things are happening, it's very easy to forget about this. So like you go to your default mode of breathing, and my default mode of breathing is not quite that good for me. And like Łukasz mentioned, it's actually quite hot here. It kind of piles up this feeling of being tired and, you know, the end of the day and things like this. But when I started thinking about, okay, I'm feeling warm and, you know, there's noise on the street, there are things happening around me, I went back to my breathing and I asked myself, why am I not relaxing it enough? What else is there that holds me from breathing in a relaxed way? And that was very interesting, because I was able to realize that probably I'm still holding on to all the things that happened before during the day. And as I realized that, I could let them go. And then the breathing came to be the one that it should be.
So your breathing is kind of a little indicator of your external indicators of your whole state.
Definitely.
Right. I feel called to nudge us to the second one, Pim, but is there anything here that you want to highlight before I do?
Thank you both for sharing that. What I love about what you're saying about breathing, Aga, is it's something that we do naturally and we do it unconsciously. And I think that curiosity is a way of like listening to all the things in a more precise way. And I think you just beautifully embodied, oh, huh. And I think that sound, huh, is something that we sometimes do as a practice of just saying the sound of curiosity, which also allows you to be open and more relaxed. Every time I make that sound, I feel open to explore, even in difficult conversations where I feel shutting down or breathing, getting more stuck. I'm like, okay, huh. And then like my shoulders go down and I get relaxed, and it's my hack to stay curious in more difficult situations.
Since you touched this subject, could you explore a little bit, if it doesn't break the exercise too much? Because somehow you put together being able to observe and being relaxed, as if observation under stress is more difficult or impossible?
I don't have the right answer. I know that for myself, when I am under stress, I react differently and I observe different things. So usually when I'm under stress, it is in a work situation, and usually work situations are with other people. And when I am under stress, I am less observing what is going on for the other person, and I'm more concerned with a very short, small perspective of whatever needs to get done.
My two cents to that is, from a neuroscience and psychological level, we can point to reactive brain states. But for myself, what I will say is, when I am in a stressful situation and I lose touch with this first principle, rather than observing and taking in all of the information that's available, I will speedily move towards finding evidence to fit a pre-existing story and model. And because the stress implies that there's a scarcity in either time or resources or something, and I'm going to use some pre-existing model, system, strategy to quicken the gap of the stress. And even that is sort of a story in and of itself. Mm-hmm. So the observing is the reminder for me that there's actually more information available, and also to even question why the stress is happening. Is this actually a stressful moment? Or is it just an old habit? Mm-hmm. Sort of? But that's an excellent question.
Just a little bit off topic. I think it applies to your idea you had just before we started about having a verb and another word next to it. I mean, my engineering brain says you want to observe broadband spectrum, because I could also think I'm just observing to see if I have to run now or not, and could be narrow-banded, right?
No, absolutely right.
There is another thing that comes to my mind as you're saying this, and this is, we all suffer through confirmation bias, right? We are looking for things that confirm this state that we are in. And it's unavoidable. Like, we are going to fall in that trap over and over again, because this is the way our brain deals with the complexity of the world. At the same time, when you are observing broadbandedly, if this is even a word,
Brobdingnagian word,
you are more likely to look for some falsification signs rather than just confirmation of your pre-existing belief. And this is the fascinating thing, because it allows you to stay curious to start with and to question your preconceptions, which goes from being curious to changing your worldview, really, right? Even if it's a tiny change.
And so to that point, that's well, not just to the second one, which is something that you both already did naturally. The second principle and the sort of step in the curiosity path is what we call suspending. And this is temporarily being open to possibility of something new. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, for me, an easy juncture point to remembering this muscle is the last time that I watched a fictionalized piece of content, a TV show, a movie, or maybe I read a book. This is a complete make-believe, and yet we use what we call the suspension of disbelief to allow the story to unfold, and these actors are playing these characters and that sort of stuff. And we do that so automatically that at some point in time, we learn how to do that, where we ask an adult, like, well, what's up with this? And they were like, oh, let's just pretend, and you just kind of take it for granted. Mm-hmm. So what I ask is, what I observed in both of you immediately after Pim kind of guided that kind of observing moment was, both of you had a natural inclination to start asking questions. And I heard you sort of suspend for a moment that need to look at the recording, and also the kind of suspending of breathing pattern. You were able to use that moment of observing to notice what was happening and kind of like actively shift that, suspend it temporarily. You shifted your focus away from whatever the automatic thing was. So just take a moment and kind of reflect on that. And I would invite the audience, and whatever thing kind of came up for them in a similar way, just noticing like how automatic that piece is. And we'll oftentimes do it as soon as we start observing and kind of pause for a moment, those questions will emerge and the thing will kind of lift itself.
I would say the mental state that I enter into a situation, because I can easily catch myself disagreeing with another version of the story that I thought of. Like, we have predictive mind, so you come to any situation with a story and the story gets confirmed or rejected in that situation. And I've noticed that if I come with this stressful mindset, I have a tendency to turn much more goal-oriented and therefore looking for the confirmation of my story than spanning the space for it. So thinking, okay, like, does it really matter that it's done my way? Perhaps if we do it the different way, it's going to be different, just different. And doesn't mean that it's better or worse, that there shouldn't be a judgment in it. What I'm trying to do a lot, and of course this is super difficult when I get stressed, but is to, even if I catch myself saying, I think that it should be like this, say like, okay, like, wait a moment, let's explore it before I have that particular conclusion. So like you said, it's a practice. And this practice for me changes the tension of a belief that I've been raised with, that there is a right answer. So it allows me to say that there is multiple right answers, or maybe there is no right answer. Maybe all of them are wrong, but just one that we choose might be more interesting to start with. It doesn't even have to be, you know, a better one. It's going to take us into a situation which is new. That would be already a bonus, right?
I think I will be an outlier at this particular axis. At least in my professional life, I have a background in research, as in, is it possible at all? Does physics allow this or that to go 10 times faster? But, you know, that part of my career has been closed for some years now. But I have a suspicion that it built a muscle. Either it's the same muscle that you mentioned or a really, really similar one. That I have much bigger tolerance for uncertainty. And if I interact with other people, my capability of comfortably holding partially resolved things in the air with some connections between them, maybe not yet confirmed, is greater than other people. So if it somehow relates to your question, it is possible to overtrain this muscle compared to other people, and then you are again a really difficult person to talk to.
That's so true.
And I think this is why I was also hired by the company I'm with now. And
they are suffering through it now.
Yes, they are. I mean, I'm aware of that, so at least that helps. But when I'm trying to talk with someone with a Gordian knot of problems, like if you look beyond your daily work, there's always this kind of Gordian knot and these loops reinforcing one another. Then I'm really checking how much I can a little bit pull it apart without them being overwhelmed or feeling, you know, really uncomfortable. Oh my gosh, so many things, I'm going to ever manage all of them. So I just stretch it a little bit, and I keep, if it doesn't go all the way I could go, I just keep this stuff for myself. And then next time when they are comfortable with this, I maybe pull them apart even more and say, oh, by the way, that answer we arrived to last time, cool, still kind of works, but look, there is another complication here, and I think this is how it's entangled. And I say, oh, okay, so you can try to make it comfortable for them to see the whole picture, but maybe you don't need to see the whole picture. I don't know, that's just how my brain works. And if I take a shortcut there, Aga can tell you it's really annoying.
So if, oh, I say, yes.
So if I'm tired, I mean, the stress and being tired is played to this. So if I just shoot, like, you know, and this, and this, and this, and this, these things we don't know, this one looks like that. And it's like, what the hell just happened to me? I thought I had a little problem and I just make it unsurmountable. What? Get away.
Yeah, but being tired and stressed, which, like you said, is the opposite to being curious, gets us into those shortcuts that actually don't make us too many friends, right?
No. They might save our lives in the past, but they're not very useful now.
Yeah.
if the third principle is going to be something about this being a costly process, I promise you, we don't know these principles in advance. I just wanted to say that it now occurred to me that being curious is probably a very costly thing for us, as in brain energy.
So what I want to mention, Lukasz, is sort of you're saying that if I'm constantly in that state and trained over and over, then it's hard to converse with me. And the suspension of disbelief that we train in theater or movies has a time frame. And that's why we find it so easy to get into it, and we are also getting out of it.
Okay.
This is what in, you know, many experience design or the entertainment industry is called the magic circle. And I think within suspending, what is important maybe to notice is that it's you're temporarily open. That creates the safe space of I can explore with you, but at a certain moment we can go back to the beginning state that allows you to explore openly, but not have the danger of it being always there. And I think that temporarily is very important to the principle.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, I think I also want to nudge us to the third one, which is apprenticing. And the way that we frame it is using your beginner's eyes, mind, and heart to learn by doing. So you're both sitting on a couch, and Lukasz mentioned that he's watching the recording. I'm not sure, but usually, Aga, you are leading a little bit more of the conversation and questions. So as we're apprenticing, I'm going to invite both of you to stand up and switch positions, but also and therefore switch the usual role that you're taking in the podcast.
You do realize these mics are set up differently, right? I got so make sure that sound the same.
He can't let go, can he? Right?
Yeah,
that's
can.
Not apprenticing, I know.
Lukasz, you have to suspend the activity.
I just stop with jokes. That was meant as a joke, even if it didn't sound like one. Go down with the B a little bit. Yeah, no, the other way. Yeah. Good. This one doesn't do anything. That's fine.
Okay. All right. I learned something, huh?
Depends when they allow us to switch. Could you give me some hints? How about to... Because they give us a... Oh, okay. It's apprenticeship
it's
on my own.
All right. So actually what happened is that they told us about apprenticeship. But we didn't really explore it very much. So you could ask, is there another way to explore it? Or could we go deeper? Or like, what is their reflection on what happened with us? Something like this.
What are you doing right now, Aga?
I'm actually telling what I would say, right? Instead of asking a question.
Okay, so let me try to do this.
I'm going to pause you two. Just take a moment and just observe. This is why we go back
mm-hmm.
and observe just the discomfort of not being in the familiar role or position.
So the exercise is to figure out what's happening within us.
Yeah. Also, if we had more time and things like that, we would lead actual apprenticeship things, which are like when you learn a language or when you learn to ride a bike or when you learn to cook, actually start doing some practices. A homework assignment would be for the next episode for Aga to actually engineer the episode and be tech'd enough and trained enough to be able to do that. We're only able to do snapshots mm-hmm. of things within the time span that we have. So this is practice over time.
I'm still confused what the task is.
You're currently apprenticing how to forward the conversation or how to ask the next question and move on.
Mm-hmm.
What we're doing is exactly we are remaining silent because both of you are doing the exercise. You're perfectly swapping roles, and we're letting you sit in that apprenticeship.
But I'm apprenticing with Aga right now.
The whole thing is getting the remembering that newness feels uncomfortable, and sometimes it's the idea of I only want to do the thing that I know how to do and that I'm already good at, and that if we step into newness together, it can be uncomfortable, but we're doing it together. So this is a safe space. Let's continue to sit in the discomfort.
And no one knows where it will go, which is exciting.
So where do we move from apprenticeship?
The first three are a little bit more actionable. The next three are going to seem a little bit more theoretical, but they're still an embodied form of them. And we'll do our best to kind of tap into it, but it's going to be more subtle. Even this one, this threshold that we just experienced was pretty subtle, where you're like, well, what are we doing? And it's like, no, we're doing it right now. The fourth principle is ritualizing. So what we mean by ritualizing is intentionally exploring a sequence of activities. The metaphor that I like to have is when I'm first learning how to dance, or when I'm first learning a language, there is that apprenticeship phase that is really clunky and awkward. And then the ritualizing is when I can start to make it seem more effortless. I can hold a conversation. There's smoothness to it. Pim, do you have a good ritual prompt right now?
Maybe Aga or Lukasz have any idea of a thing you always do with podcast guests? That we could do at this moment.
But then still applying the apprenticeship in whatever way, having you two switch roles doing it. Yeah,
I can think of the intro and the last question. This is the only other fixed point of our podcast.
There's a part of me that wants to. I don't know, Pim, what are you getting?
Yeah, I agree.
I agree. Pim and I agree. We feel like for to most exemplify ritualizing, that it would be appropriate to do that ritualized part here. Even though it's out of order, in your normal way of doing things, we're going to apprentice doing it different. Suspend the idea that it should be a certain way.
So normally at the end of the podcast, we ask our guests about a book, preferably one, which make it more difficult. They would invite people to read in the context of the season that we are having. But since this is a bonus episode, we have a different question for you. We would like to ask you about three tips that would help our listeners to stay curious.
Three tips. I almost want to like break the question and say one of the tips is to read a book. but I'm going to hold myself from totally doing that. Although I will say Curious Mind by Brian Grazer would be the answer to the old question. Three tips.
So the reason I'm observing Anthony's wish to break the question, and there is something underneath it, and correct me if I'm wrong, there is this wish in society to do a quick thing. How can I do it tomorrow? Give me these three tips and I'll just do it, which at many instances will help. However, we are actively trying to suspend that idea and saying that, well, these three tips are just like things you can do, but you need to understand why you're doing them and how can you apply them if you understand it best for you, and are there other ways of doing it? So I'm seeing a lot of people taking course after course after course, and they have like a list of 688 different tips to do, be more productive, be less stressed, be more graceful. And I don't know if we want to be adding to those tips.
Can I rephrase my question then? Because I totally understand what you are saying, and I'm a big disbeliever in this quick action things. So maybe you can share some tips as in triggers, because we are going through the whole course that you constructed, right? And like with all courses, you know, you get out of this pumped and I'm going to do this. And there is some forgetting curve, right? Like in 2 weeks, you remember half of it. So how about some tips for like triggers? How can I help myself going back into thinking about it or using it? So it's not about having a fix for curiosity, but the trigger to, oh yeah, I promised myself I will do this more often.
I love that reframe and watching us make this up in real time, and I'm really enjoying what we're doing right now. The first one that I'll throw in kind of first thought, best thought is the reminder, maybe we'll call these like rememberings or something, is the reminder that curiosity is already innately in you. And if you can remember a time in your life where you had that relationship to your curiosity, that will always anchor you in the future.
The thing that I will add to it is the sound of curiosity, which is one of the only words, sounds, that universally is across all languages. Huh. Or even, or even, I wonder. Just remembering to name a sound will help you stay curious, even relax some of your nervous system, because it's also remembering of the body. So it's not an intellectual exercise. It's really something else that is maybe related to you, Aga's breathing. What are other triggers that allow you to let go of tight breathing? Well, one is in your mind, but maybe something else is even having a touch point on your body. So I think, huh. And maybe we can all just say, huh.
Huh.
And maybe when you're listening, you just say it out loud and see what happens. If somebody will like laugh at you, or it feels awkward, but just get really pronounce or make it audible.
If you are listening this in a public space with your headphones, no one will look weird at you, because who knows what's going on there, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And to nudge us, Lukasz, I think without noticing too much, you're doing really well in apprenticing, leading the conversation, because you just reframed it and noticed where we're going. So I just want to say that I'm observing you being a really great apprentice.
Thank you. We are living a fractal here. Cool.
Two more.
So the fifth one is gracing. Gracing, how we define it, is acting with beauty, love, humor, and ease. So all the four principles before have kind of a way of being and trying and apprenticing, where with gracing, it just becomes more part of your day-to-day being. You have to think about it less, so it becomes sort of more of a graceful thing. So can you always gracefully breathe? Or in a meeting, you have maybe a sequence of activities that you want to do, rather than being able to stuck with them, can you gracefully be like, well, maybe this time we don't get to the end, because that's okay.
And the thing that I would add here that is really powerful about gracing is the way that Pim and I have been working with it over the many months now, is we will, in meetings, ask questions of like, do we love what we're doing right now? And have a deep conversation about that. And these four things can really shine a lot of light if you then use the curiosity of asking questions of like, where is there beauty in my life? Where is there love? Where is there humor? Where is there ease? And if those qualities are lacking in your life, then it really is a very advanced place of, you might need to like really consider what you're going to change about your life.
You are making me think about something that I started doing a few years ago. Basically, I got myself into a burnout. And when you get yourself into a burnout, you realize that there must have been signs before you ended up in this state of mind. So I've decided I'm going to put a reminder to my calendar, which pops up every 2 weeks, which asks me one simple question. It's like, how happy are you? And the scale is from 0 to 10. And basically, I'm putting the number that comes to mind. With that practice, and this is a practice of quite a few years already, I can see that when I go around 6 or below, there's definitely something that I have to change. And it's maybe not as specific as what you said, but it's a internal check to help me not to get myself into a situation when I'm sacrificing my well-being for a situation which very likely is not going to be either rewarding in any way, and actually probably most likely doesn't require that sacrifice from me. That's my little hack on that part.
Thank you for that, Aga. I want to invite you to turn towards each other. And you have a lot of ways in which your lives overlap, right? Romantically, professionally, friendship, you share a home. And you can go back and forth, and Pim, you can help me decide whether we should do each one or have one person go. But I want you to take a moment and ponder, and you're going to share with the other person, like, in what ways this life with this person has beauty, love, humor, and ease.
So you can share to the other person what is beautiful about the other person.
Wow, that's a good one. I think it's been for a while, but I never really put it in words. But it's so beautiful that you are so different from me. And it has so many repercussions, both for us together and influences on me that wouldn't happen otherwise.
I have a different way of thinking about this. Haha, obviously.
Surprise, surprise, yes.
And for me, what's really beautiful is that you make me feel confident about my path. And it helps me to make some sometimes very difficult choices that I would probably be scared of making. And it's not that it's like an active encouragement, but I just know that you are going to support me no matter what path I choose. So it's easier to choose the difficult one.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That feels complete. You want to take us to flowing, Pim?
Yeah, and with that, we're flowing into flowing, which is moving smoothly and continuously from moment to moment. And recognizing that our time together also has an ending, and that endings are new beginnings. And without embracing flowing, which also can be death, it's harder to embody all the other principles even. And it's also the last principle, and it's maybe the most difficult one.
It feels like age helps with the last one. At least how I decode flow, this is different than a drive to achieve, kind of a hard drive. Probably in some situations they can be one and the same thing, but there is, I mean, even if you think of martial arts, this flow is something you get in time and it's kind of effortless, and it's something different for me than this hard drive to get something. Maybe you need both, maybe you need them separately in different parts of your life, but somehow flow connects with maturity in my head.
I have a slightly different association with it. In a workshop that I recently participated, we were supposed to draw something and then embody it with movement. Some people had an object and some people had a story there. My picture was one of three mountains, one bigger than the other, and then the fourth mountain on the side. So you can imagine that. I drew it very intuitively, so I didn't really have a story behind it. And as I started to embody this picture, I realized that the story was about goal orientation versus flow. Like, you climb a mountain, you get to the top of it, but then there is a bigger mountain ahead of you. So what you do, you have to go down and you have to start all over again. And then you get there and there's another even bigger mountain. And then you have to go down and start all over again. And this is life that a lot of us live. There's another job, another project, another position, another challenge that we kind of approach in this goal orientation with a hope that there is something on the top that gives you satisfaction. But for me, as I was embodying it, there was no satisfaction because you saw that there was this other thing. So you couldn't really be happy about the thing that was happening on that top of the mountain. And you knew that you have to go down and then you have to walk up again. And it's going to be tiring. And after a third mountain, frankly, you imagine that there will be a fourth and the fifth and the sixth. And, you know, this is your life, really. And then as I was climbing the third top, I could see the fourth mountain that was to the side, which was also really big. It was as big as the third mountain. But I realized that if I see it not as a goal, but as a journey, of course, there will be moments when I'm tired. There will be moments when I'm down, not really feeling like walking the mountain anymore. But it becomes a journey through the mountains rather than getting to another top and another top and another top. And it really drastically changed my way of thinking about the things that I'm doing in life. And of course, like, this is such a cliche to say that this is about the journey, not the destination, duh. But this picture and this movement in my body and the feeling that I was getting out of it gave me an understanding, like very vascular understanding of where the change lies. So it connects with my breathing, of course, and the breathing exercises, because when you climb a mountain to get to a goal, you all tense, right? Because you are on a mission. You have to get there. So you tighten your belly, you pull your buttocks, and you are going for it, right? And when you are walking through a flow, the whole thing is that your body relaxes. Of course, your muscles are active, but the whole state of your body is very, very different, because it's not about the short-term burn of energy to get there, but the long-term maintenance of energy so you can walk as long as you want. That's what your story triggered in me.
Maybe to tie it back to the beginning where we were sharing that we were just showing up. One of the things we also asked each other is, what if this was the last time we showed up? Are we satisfied with all the things we just did? Was it meaningful to ourselves? And often that time was yes. So trying to embody the thing that we're doing as being valuable and meaningful to ourselves, and therefore happy with that moment to moment, or, you know, that journey across the mountains.
I'm trying to summarize this principle, how they make me, how you made me think going through these exercises. I can't stop to wonder, is this really the curiosity that your masterclass is about? I can see the first three principles being tied to curiosity indeed. But the other two, I think, I'm just shooting from the hip here, but I think if we tried a little bit, we could build them on top of a different foundation or not.
I would first have us take a step back and ask you what your operating definition of curiosity is.
Correct me if I'm wrong. I think we agreed that it is something that we have in us. Mm-hmm. And it is about getting the information in. At least for me, curiosity is not necessarily with doing stuff with that information later on. I can think of a, I don't know, like highly niche theoretical scientist exploring something that really is difficult to put into any kind of output. These people have to be curious. So there's that part of gathering, and we also discussed having a really, really broad band of this information intake, not filtering through our own brain, trying to pull very quick decisions out of it. Mm-hmm. And then the principles, at a certain moment, for me, they go into much broader concept of living well. And I cannot stop suspecting that there is more than curiosity to live well. So suppose I'm a person who really end up on your masterclass, but I still come with this brain that you experienced. It has softened over the years, but, you know, for me, everything is interconnected blocks. And I see how these blocks build on one another. I just see that those blocks at the top, they need much more stuff than just curiosity. Curiosity is part of it, but not the other way around.
Within our brain, one of the things that curiosity does is it's very similar to being hungry. So when we are feeling hungry or craving food, there's a part in our brain that lights up, which is similar to when we are curious. And the moment we are eating food, the moment we are satisfying our curiosity, is also the similar like pleasure part of our brain that is satisfied. That is closely related to a very primary source of us as human beings, similar to food. So stacking on curiosity and asking questions, exactly what you're doing right now, are these even part of curiosity? That's curiosity at play. And therefore, it's sort of a foundation in your brain for living a good life, for continuing as Homo sapiens species to develop and to embrace life in a certain way.
First of all, guys, thank you so much for doing this exercise with us.
Thank you both for being sports and playing with us and getting into that space. It was really, really great.
Awesome.
So thank you.
The last question that I would love to ask you is, where do you two see this project going? And if people want to find about the course, where can they find you?
So at this moment in time that we're recording this, who knows when someone might listen to this, there is a 4-week masterclass curriculum that they can find at architectingcuriosity.com, which there'll be a link to. If there's not an active sign up for a class cohort, it's best to sign up for the newsletter and they'll get updates about when the signups of the applications will become available. As far as the future of it, we are attempting to follow the curiosity as much as possible while holding a North Star of seeing how this curriculum can become a different form of education and learning. And we want to really explore for our own curiosity what it looks like in the traditional spaces of education to begin to learn the muscle of curiosity and how we ask questions and why we ask questions, not just the theory behind it, but the actual practicality of it. And for ourselves, like, go on that journey and learn.
One of the things that I'm fascinated by while diving into it is how little books have been written about curiosity. The very small amount of research that has been done. So it's almost curious that as a society, it doesn't have a similar space of talking about it as creativity or innovation. I think that now more than ever in whatever time frame I can perceive as a human, having the right answer becomes less important than taking the time to ask the right questions. And that's a very big reframe in how society is currently built up. So I love for this project to be one of many who spreads the conversation around curiosity. And then last but not least, one of the things we talk about in the masterclass, and which I'm also inviting the five of us right now, sorry, the four of us. I was thinking there was a cat.
He was here. He just left.
There is a moment of pause and being done and having to take a rest. And this is the end of our masterclass. It's like 1 week is full diving into taking a rest or even an active rest, which we talked about at the beginning. So this is the moment that I think we're all going to take a rest.
Guys, thank you so much. We really appreciate this exercise.
Thank you for doing this to us.
Thank you for playing.
And thank you for spending this time with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Catching the Next Wave podcast. We would love to hear from you on Twitter at Malka6 and at DLS6. You can find more details on www.catchingthenextwavepodcast.com.
What is that question, Aga? How did what all start when?